Welcome to episode 126 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson. This week I have the talk I gave to the Cincinnati Agile Roundtable on March 3rd about Seaside and Web Velocity. If you have feedback on this or any other episode of Industry Misinterpretations, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. You can also head on over to iTunes and leave a comment for us. We would really appreciate it if you did that. You can head on over to Podcast Alley, cast a vote for the podcast. And of course, you can interact with us in the Industry Misinterpretations group of Facebook and the Small Talkers group at Ning.
I guess I should ask, given that there are a bunch of people who are students, how many people are familiar at all with Smalltalk? And how many people have actually used Smalltalk?
In production? No.
There's lots of that. And I'll also...
You're right in line with that, kid.
Well, no, actually, the side remark I normally make to people is the SynCom has made more money from Smalltalk than Sun has ever made from Java. IBM, no, that's not the case. Sun, yes.
Sun, yeah.
So, be that as it may, though. What I'm here to talk about is web development in Smalltalk, for the most part, using Seaside. How many of you are familiar at all with Seaside, or have even heard of it? Okay, so most of you don't have much of an idea what Seaside is, so I'm going to start with some basics. What I'm going to do is, this is the development environment. I guess another question I could ask is, how many of you have looked at VisualWorks recently? Okay, so it's not that you should have looked at VisualWorks recently somewhat. I mean, I'd like if you have, but be that as it is, is that it does tell me how many questions I have to answer up front. What I'm doing right now is going to the component manager so that I can load in the Seaside environment. So I'm going to go to Seaside Web Development, and I'm going to pick this top one, Seaside, and then I'm going to click Load. And a couple of things are going to happen. First, it's going to load in all the necessary prerequisites, and it's going to load in the Seaside environment itself. And then it's going to bring up the browser, because what it did, and I'm going to make this browser smaller because I normally run a lot higher resolution than I've got available to me right now, is it brought up the browser because I'm running a server over on the Smalltalk side. So if I were to go over here in the Seaside menu, I would see that I'm running a server. So I've got my server up, it's running, I've got start and stop options. So it's there, it's running on a port, and it happens to be running, as it happens, on port 7777. The way you would deploy this, if you wanted to put a Seaside server in production, is like you would deploy a lot of other things. You can use proxy pass, you can use some kind of redirect. It's not hard to do if you're using Apache. If you're using the Microsoft web technology, I feel sorry for you already, but it can, in fact, be done. So you can do that. Just to give you an example, let's go here to the examples. I'm going to go to this simple canonical example that Seaside has. And I haven't really explained Seaside yet, and that's partly because I want to show you a couple of things that are kind of interesting. I'm just going to do this with the counter. I'm going to add a couple of times, get up to 5, then I'm going to hit the back button twice. If I now go ahead and hit the plus, what do you think the answer is going to be?
4.
4.
Yes, and the reason for that is, if you look up top, you see the rather long, ugly URL there, underscore S equal. What Seaside is doing here is it's holding on to what's called a continuation. When I go back with the back button, encoded in there is basically session information. Back on the server, I've got the context stack saved in memory. And if I go back, when this page comes through to the server again, the server says, oh, I'm getting a submission from this point in the stack. Let's just roll back there and run. And it's because in Smalltalk, you can keep that stack information around. When you're in the debugger, for instance, if you get an exception, one of the neat things about Java, if you want to call it neat, or C#, is the same way. By the time you get to the exception, the stack's been unwound and thrown away, which means that you can't really do a lot with it. In Smalltalk, the stack's still there, so you can kind of rewind time and go back to where you wanted to. And from a development perspective, you can play the same trick, and that's really what's going on here. Now, let's go to the code, and let me show you what's going on there. Because if you're familiar with, I heard a couple of people say they were working on web projects of one sort or another. how many people have built a web application of some kind, and it doesn't matter what technology, you've built web applications in some kind of technology, I presume. So you've got something with web pages, you've got your HTML page here, and you've got your code over here, and you've got some kind of server technology bridging the two things in the middle somehow. Well, Seaside's different than that. So let's go ahead and we'll find a class, and the class I'm looking for is WA Counter. This is the entire class right here that does this. I'll click off the comment to the definition. It has one attribute called count. That's an instance variable. This is the entirety of code that manages that little stupid application. And this is all the rendering right here. Notice there's no HTML page. And there's a reason for that. All the rendering is done from the language. What this means is that when you get a problem, you're debugging in the environment. You don't have the problem of having an HTML page with some code on it or with some tags on it, and then having your code over here, and then having to kind of move back and forth between the two and having a debugger that doesn't bridge the gap real well. I've done that kind of technology. In Smalltalk, we have that kind of Smalltalk server page kind of technology as well. Debugging that is often somewhat painful. If you do this, on the other hand, this is where all of my code is going. So you see, I'm putting out the heading up at the top, and I have an anchor. Notice the way the anchor's action is specified. Instead of having to build a servlet and having my servlet here and the code that invokes the servlet over on the HTML page, I just handed a block of code. So that's just a block of code there in square brackets, and in there I've got self-increase, and that method is called whenever I press the plus-plus. Likewise, self-decrease is called whenever I press the minus-minus, and that's done through that callback mechanism. That's all encapsulated right here. So the entire page's behavior is encapsulated here. And just for jollies, what I'm going to do is go over here, and I'm going to break this by putting quotes around this. So I'm going to say, I think that'll break. Unless somebody's implemented plus in a way that I don't expect.
Seaside.
Yep. No, that hasn't been done. So I get an exception here because I cannot add a number and a string. In most web technologies at this point, you're kind of dead in the water. You can't really debug. In Seaside, I can. And the only thing I have to remember is that my debugger is here. So I have to get this window up to the front, hit debug, and I get a debugger. Now, the thing to remember here is I'm in the middle of the hit. I'm debugging intra-hit. I'm not debugging after the fact. I'm not looking at a context stack that's been dumped by the server later. I'm looking at this in the middle of that processing. So I go here to plus, I notice that it said, well, I can't add this to this, so that's why it blew up. What I can do is go back here, and I can say, well, I know what the problem is, and while this one is the bug I just introduced, I can recompile it right there, and when I recompile it, notice what happened. You look at the top there, you notice the stack rejiggered. Even though I went back to previous points in the execution chain, I recompiled from that point, the future execution vaporized, and this is where I am. If I go ahead and just proceed, now back, and it worked. So the thing is when you get a problem and you're debugging in Seaside, you can just keep going. In fact, you can introduce breakpoints and halts in your code at points where you say, I don't understand what's going on. This is often the way Smalltalkers program, by the way. Smalltalkers often code in the debugger. That's because the debugger in Smalltalk, this is an argument you'll see raging in the Ruby community and in the Java community and the C# community, is people telling you there are people who will advocate never using the debugger because you should write unit tests and never have to see the debugger. In Smalltalk, the debugger is a browser that knows how to debug. So in fact, when you get to a point where you're sitting there and you have two choices, should I try to keep all the state that would possibly be in existence in my head, or should I just say, I'm not that smart, I'm going to let the system break, and then I'm going to see where it broke, and then I'm going to write the code in the debugger, since the debugger is nothing more than a fancy browser that knows how to debug, and then I'm just going to go along my merry way and not have to think 3, 4, 5 steps ahead. I'm not a master chess player, not a grandmaster. I don't know how to keep 10 moves in my head ahead of time. I'd rather just let the computer do that. It's good at that kind of thing. So I keep all that state in there instead of going out. Now, it's one thing for me to show you an application that's already written. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to go ahead and add a new package, and I'm going to call this Hello World. So the canonical Hello World type of example, so let's go down to that. And I'm going to add a new class, I'm going to call this hello, and it's going to come from seaside.wa component, because as it turns out, anything that is a component in Seaside is subclassed from this guy. And Seaside, the way it renders things is every single piece of the web page that you want rendered is a component. So if you wanted to have a header, you wanted to have a body, you wanted to have some sidebars, each one of those could be a component. In fact, little snippets of each of those could be their own components, and each one of them would in turn know how to render itself. And then that's how they would come on the page, is through this kind of thing. So I'm going to create this, and I'm going to go ahead, and I'm going to write a new method called render content on, and it's going to take an argument, and that is the way we write keyword messages in Smalltalk. If I were doing that in Java or C Sharp, it would be render content on, parenthesis, argument, parenthesis, you know, like that, but in Smalltalk, we do it this way. So we have keyword name followed by an argument. If I wanted to pass two arguments, it'd be keyword, colon, argument, another keyword, colon, argument. It also means that in a language like, back when I was a C programmer, it was often very easy to transpose arguments. So I'd have something that took two or three integers, and it'd be very easy to get them mixed up as to where they go. Smalltalk, this almost never happens because you can name the arguments this way. I could say something like start server on, colon, port number, IP address, colon, IP number, blah, blah, blah. The likelihood of ever transposing numbers in that is very low because I can name everything. Now, that doesn't stop you from running bad code. You can write COBOL in any language. But as long as you follow conventions, you should have something that's reasonably well understood. Now, all I have to do if I want to have this work the way I want is something like this, HTML text, hello world. And now the only thing I need to do is I need to add a little bit of code here. And the reason I need to add this is that, again, when I went here, you notice that I have this list of things coming up on the front page, these links. I need to tell the server where to locate this guy in that. So I'm going to add a class initialization method. And I'm going to say, and I've forgotten the name of this method, so I'm going to do this. I'm going to cheat WA counter. And I'm going to come over to the class side and see what it's called here. It registers application. So I write this. Now I have to execute that in order to have the server take awareness of that. And I'm going to do this the easy way. I'm just going to highlight it, tell it to do it. And the other nice thing about Smalltalk is if you can see it, you can execute it. So I'm in the browser here. I just executed that code. So now if I come back here, I now have hello world, and there it is. So it's working. And I can come back here, and I can say, let's go to this render content on. Let's change this to strong. So let's go back, and we'll reload it, and there it is. So the nice thing is that you build this up in code, and then you can get immediate feedback and work back and forth. And if you run into problems where you have to debug something, you're, again, still in the flow of the debugger in the system. You're never taken out of that flow by going out to an HTML editor. You're always in one place. Now, is this the best tool for writing every kind of web thing available? No. If you're writing a straight website where you need all the URLs to be static, this is probably not the best tool for doing that. This is really, the Seaside is really intended for writing web applications more than websites, which is not to say you can't write websites with it. You can specify URLs to be static. You can do that in the system. But in general, its strength is in building web applications. So that's kind of a brief introduction to Seaside. What I wanted to do next...
Can I ask a question based on that?
Yeah, sure.
Because we've had these conversations as part of the Agile Roundtable. One of the things that I try to have us talk about is the breakpoints between when different technologies are useful. Mm-hmm. Right? When would you use PHP rather than going to Rails? When would you use Java rather than... We don't have that conversation too often. but one of them I've just started kind of kicking around is you know, we've got a Rails bias in the group. We've got a lot of people working with Rails. But I'm seeing a real a breakpoint that if I had an application that had lots of workflow rather than REST kind of issues. Mm-hmm. I think that's the way I would look and say maybe workflow issues are more in line with what CSIDE could give us. Is that, you think that's...
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And REST, just plain REST stuff is maybe not the strong point of this. Would you also
probably
say
not.
That?
You can make pages that have actual URLs that are bookmarkable.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, as a matter of fact, in a moment I'll show you one way we do that. But the thing is that CSIDE's strong point is writing web applications as opposed to websites. And kind of, I'm not going to contrast it to Ruby on Rails, but I'm going to say there's one similarity, and that is kind of from a thinking standpoint. Ruby on Rails was described as an opinionated software in the sense that David Hanemeyer Hansen, when he set it up, said, you're going to write your code this way. You're going to structure your directory structure this way. You're going to write everything like this. You're not going to go doing it some other way. I'm going to give you a set of rules, and as long as you follow those rules, you'll be fine. CSIDE's also opinionated. It's just got a completely different set of opinions, which isn't to say that they're better opinions. It is different opinions. So CSIDE says, what if you ignored the part about throwing away state? CSIDE is very stateful. Instead of assuming you don't want state, CSIDE says, well, what if you had state? What if you wanted to write something more like an actual application where the user didn't have to worry about hitting the back button? What if hitting the back button was supported when you wanted it to be supported? It doesn't mean you have to support it everywhere. There are times when you wouldn't want the user to go back. But the thing is that you can support it easily and without really having to give it too much thought, because it'll backtrack everything and anything you want it to. So you can have it keep track of all the state you want it to and not keep track of any state you don't want it to. So it kind of really depends on what kind of application you're writing and what kind of thing you're trying to create. I'd say that its strong point is writing applications. It's not that you can't write, you know, RESTful websites. That's really not where it's aimed, right? It's aimed at writing web applications.
Well, good. Good to have confirmation around.
What's the reaction to designers to writing their pages in Smalltalk?
Well, designers don't have to write their pages on Smalltalk. The thing is, are you familiar with DabbleDB?
Yes.
Yeah, it's Abby Bryant's business, and Abby was one of the co-developers of CSIDE. His designer is not a Smalltalker, doesn't know Smalltalk, basically, generally speaking, can't identify it. I mean, other than the fact that he's been working with the Dabble guys, so I'm sure he's somewhat familiar now. But he picked a designer from the group of people that worked on Zen Garden. CSS Vanguard. You got one of the people who's responsible for that to do their design, and they just create CSS layouts for them. And then they apply those CSS layouts, so the guy will tell them, if you want it to look like this, put your divs with these IDs here, make sure these things belong to this class. And that's pretty much the way you proceed. Your designer doesn't need to know Smalltalk any more than if you write it like my blog server that I run on the SynCom site. I didn't do the style sheets for that. Somebody else did. So I had those created by a guy who knows something about CSS, and he just told me, make sure your posts have these IDs, make sure your footers have these IDs, make sure the headers have these IDs, and then I just made sure that all the stuff I emit conforms to that, and you do the same thing with CSIDE. You just make sure that your stuff emits the appropriate information that your designer tells you.
The designer never gets into the HTML at all, no. They're just going with CSS.
They just work in CSS. And the interesting thing is that to do this, now, CSS is not my strong point, so let's see if I can remember this. I think it's style. You just answer a string. So if I say, you're going to have to probably help me out. If I wanted any tag that's strong to be read, what's the CSS for that?
I think it's just strong without the period in front.
Strong.
But you need the...
You're right. I need this and that.
Well, no. I'm sorry. No. Go back. The curly brackets come after the structure.
Right. Yeah.
There you go. But no curly bracket there either.
No curly bracket?
And the curly bracket now. And then color.
Colon, right?
Colon red.
What, red?
Yeah, should be.
I think I have to put a semicolon after that or not.
No, that's good.
Sure. So, if we did that correctly.
If we didn't, we can fix it.
So, the thing is, that is not the way you would normally embed style in a CSIDE app. normally you would there, and there's a way of specifying external style libraries. So normally you do it the way you put style in any application. You have a CSS file sitting somewhere in your directory structure that's served by your Apache server or whatever server you're using. But if you wanted to hand something to a user as a single self-contained thing and tell them, and not have to tell them, here are the 5,000 little pieces you have to assemble to get this thing to work, you can say, just here's an image, and you've thrown your CSS into it like this, tell me what you think. And you know, if they get a BARF that I got immediately, you say, well, okay, back to the drawing board. You can embed it all like this, and at least have somebody take a look at it without having to give them all those little pieces to assemble. So you can put everything in the image and experiment with your style and everything else like this, and then later on extract it out and put it into an external file like you normally would. So you can embed style like this if you want. Normally you would push it out somewhere else. All right, let me move on from this. I'm going to kill this image. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring up something different. I find this, and I need to move that aside. We're going to go into applications. And I'm going to bring up Web Velocity. And Velocity is a Smalltalk C-side environment that runs inside the web browser. So here, I am not using a Smalltalk browser to write code. I am working right here in the browser environment. My debugger is in this environment. So to show you what I mean, let's go up here and create a new application. So I'm going to call this Hello World, so we'll make it very much like the other one. I'm not working with the database, so I'm going to turn schema off. Schema means that I want to have a database. The database support that is in this, and I'll run through a little example of that in a moment, uses the active record pattern. So if you're familiar with Ruby and Ruby on Rails, you know what active record is. We built a Smalltalk version of that on top of an object relational mapping system we've already got. So instead of just having the thin active record pattern, we've got a full object relational mapping system underneath it. So if you need to dodge around active record for reasons of complexity, you can. But if you don't need to, you can just stay right at active record. So let's just go with this. And now I have this whole set of things. I want to have a new component. Now I have a bunch of things I can do. I'm not going to get into tasks or file libraries, but file libraries is where you would specify external things like CSS. What I'm going to do is I'm going to create a component, and I'm going to call it hello. I'm going to register it as an application. I'm going to not use the template, and I'm not going to configure it for Glorp. Glorp is our object relational mapper, so I'm just going to have to be a very bare bones thing. And now I'm going to come in and go to the source code. And notice the browser style is a little different than you would normally see. So I come in here, and I'm going to say HTML text. Now notice how that little red is coming up there? What that's doing is it's telling me right off what my problem is. I close the mouse over, and it'll tell me that I've not completed something. And the other cool thing about this is when I complete this, I don't have to physically compile the method. At any point where I've reached syntactic correctness, my method is already compiled. So I don't have to hit a control key, I don't have to pull down a menu, I don't have to do anything. At any point where everything stops being read, I've reached syntactic correctness, I can just try it. That doesn't mean it'll run. You know, as anybody who's done some Smalltalk, or any other language for that matter, just because the compiler's happy doesn't mean anything else is happy. But it does mean I don't have to do an extra step here. Now at this point, I can come in here and I can go to Browse, try it out, and there it is. So, go back, show you something kind of neat about this. Let's go here and say 1 + 1. That's syntactically correct, but it should break. So we'll go here again and do a Browse World. And now it's going to give me this debug again. But notice the difference here. I'm now in the browser. I've got my debugger. Instead of having the small step of getting out of flow in the browser and going to the Smalltalk environment, I now have even less. I'm right here. I can see it telling me in blue where the problem is. So I can come in here and say, well, let's change this to, and comma just concatenates. Now the blue is telling me where it would start executing if I proceeded. That's what the blue means. And the column means concatenation, so this says concatenate the string 1 with the string 2. So now if I go ahead and hit this, which will continue, just continues right there in the browser. So I didn't even have to get out of my workflow of being in the browser. Now, that's a fairly simple-minded application. It's not terribly exciting. But what I can do is I can have, let's go back to the top and let's add a different one. We're going to add a new application, and this is going to use databases. So I'm going to call this, oh, let's say Agile Log Server, since that's where we are. When I went on a road trip last summer, I ended up having about four different versions of this, and I took to calling them Log Server 1, 2, 3, and 4 as I went through cities. So people later on knew where I was coming from. So now I'm going to go ahead and hit OK. And at this point, I have to give it some information. You notice there are a bunch of additional pieces of information up here. Database. I tell it which database do I want to use. I pick one from the list here. Common ones you might want. MySQL, Oracle, Postgres. So I'm going to pick Postgres, and I'm going to say my host is localhost. My port is 5432. The database is Postgres. And the database is, no, that's right. The username is Postgres. And I've got a password. I test login. It'll tell me whether it worked. And it'll tell me it's configured, so now I know I've got a working database connection. And this is my database here. I've got Postgres on this machine. So now what I can do is I can come over to the schema in the classes. And I want to go ahead and see what's out there. So I'm going to go to my mappings, and it'll tell me which things I've got. So I've got this public set of tables here. I want to pick, say, the posts. So I'm going to do this, and I'm going to select all of these. So I'm going to say OK. And then I want to pick comment. I'm going to create that. Let's select all those and hit OK. Now, if I look at the mappings by going to the classes, let's go over to the source code. You notice that I've got this stuff. It's already generated a whole bunch of stuff here. And if I go to the mappings, you'll see that it's already got the mapping set up from host to comment. So it's already figured out that there's a foreign key relationship between these two things. And I can also go here to this and go browse. And here I've got something that looks like it normally there. Now I've already got some stuff in the database because I've been screwing around with this at various points. So this shows you that I've got a post and it's got a link to the individual thing, which I can edit immediately. So I've got a basic setup there. Now this can be customized, obviously. I wouldn't be happy if this is all it did for me and this is the only kind of look I could get. So there are a couple of different things I can do. One thing I can do that's very simple is I can go to themes and I can say, well, what about this one here? So let's say I wanted this one and I want to see what that would look like there. It's going to show me how it would look in that kind of setup. And setting up new themes is just a simple matter of going in and knowing a little bit about CSS and throwing these in. But there's more basic customization you can do. So let me close down some of these additional windows tabs here. Go over here, let's go back to class, let's go back to the top actually, and we'll go to the overview. It does give you an idea of things you should do before you publish. You should put some kind of summary of your application down here, so it's kind of giving you a broad hint that you ought to document it. And another thing I can do is I can immediately publish this to my repository, and the repository is an SQLite database, so it'll just publish it into your SQLite database. And then up here, I can go to various different repositories. At the moment, I don't have access to anything but local because I have no internet connection. But let's go up to the top and just show you where I can take this. I could write some code for this, but the thing is that let me load a version of this that I was working on earlier today. So I'm going to go to this, which is the same thing, but with some more customization in it. So let's go to post.html. And here I've got it in more of a blog-type format. So I've got latest post, second post. If I go to the individual one, it's going to show me all the comments with this customized. Now, if you want to see how you customize this, let's go to the code. So I'm going to go to the post view UI, and let's go to the source. This is also a little different. If you're used to Smalltalk, one of the things a lot of people have questions about in terms of the browser is the whole one method view at a time thing. And notice what I've got here is I've got a view where I can go ahead and look at as many methods as I want and be editing multiple methods at the same time in here. So I've got this view. It's kind of more like a file type view, even though I'm not really editing files. I'm still editing in the environment. But this is how I customize this. It turns out that if I wanted to have the ability to add a comment, I needed to, and I've already got the hookup with the foreign key relationship in the database, but all I needed was to add this. So if I go over here, notice how there's an additional add comment here that wasn't there before in my the simple version that got generated for me. To add that, all I needed to do is write this one method. Have a callback of add comment with the string add comment, and then super render actions on. And super just means go to the super class, invoke the inherited behavior. So this is just adding an additional button to that list, which is how the add comment button got on there. So the super class gave me these three, and then I added this one. And then over here, I just have add comment, and then that method is down here somewhere. Actions, there it is. So there's my add comment method right there. And all it does, this is kind of an interesting thing. This is one of the ways Seaside is kind of neat here, is normally if I had an add comment, I'd have to have some kind of servlet set up where I have the link or the button, and it would go back to servlet, and I'd have a couple of different things going on the server. Here, I have one method. Create a new comment, then call comment editor UI, and then I have this if true block. What's going on here is this is very much like GUI programming. In GUI programming, if you're writing a client-server application, you would have something where you'd probably pop up a dialog box or a new window at this point, and you say, you know, open the comment editor, and then you'd have some kind of true-false type clause after saying, well, if the user hit the OK button, add the comment. If the user canceled it, don't add the comment, right? In web programming, you're pretty much never able to do that exact workflow. You have to go through kind of a convoluted set of actions, except in Seaside. In Seaside, you can do it just like it's done in GUI programming. You can pretty much follow that same workflow where I call this additional editor onto the screen, and you see if I go over here, add comment, there it is. If I cancel, there I go back. If I instead add the comment and hit accept, notice I have a bug. So that's no demo is complete unless I have a bug. But leaving the bug aside, apparently, I know what that is. They changed the API. Hang on, passages. What they did is they changed the API on me. This version was done a few releases ago. This, for some reason, they decided save was the wrong name for this. I'm not sure why they decided that, but they decided it needed to be something else. So it's actually not named save anymore. That's the problem. I can go look for it, but that would probably bore people to tears. But it's because there's been an API change, and I didn't keep track of that. This is the more interesting stuff here, is down here. This is how you customize things. Render details on. Let me show you what's going on here. If I go to visibility, let's go up to a superclass, near view UI, and let's go down here to render details on. Notice there's this inherited version of render details on. And this is a very simple one that's just going through and iterating through all of the variables that I've got from the database, all of the ones that are in my domain object, and it's iterating through them and slamming them down in kind of a tabular view. That's how I got that default layout you saw when I did the first little example. And what I decided is that's not what I want. I'm writing a blog server, so what I kind of want is, most recent to least recent, just iterate through and go down and put them all in some kind of more list-type format. So instead of having the table that it's going to put for me here, I overwrote render details on and wrote it myself and factored it out so that it puts out the title, then puts out the post details, then a rule, and then the render comments on. And that's just me factoring code so that I iterate through the comments, have some more code. Notice how you put out things like paragraphs and text. It's just a matter of putting out a block of code. And you can do the same thing with divs, by the way. I didn't use any divs or IDs in this, but you do the same thing if you want a structure with CSS. It's the same kind of thing. You put out a div, give it an ID, put out a class with an ID, and then later on you apply the CSS to it, and all the right things happen. So it's just a matter of doing that, putting that kind of Seaside code out. So this is how you do things in Web Velocity to customize. So instead of getting this kind of behavior, I end up with something that looks more like this. So I get this listing of methods and stuff that goes down like this. So instead of that default tabular view, which you can see if I go back here to, if I go back to my, this one, and I go to the posts, notice the difference. This is the basic layout, which is this kind of tabular layout like this. So that's the default layout, and then this is the way I customized it. So you can customize it like this. Now these layouts, this scaffolding, is there for you to use if you want to. If you notice, when I created the new component, one of the things it asked me about is whether I wanted the scaffolding or not. Some applications you'll want the scaffolding, and some applications you won't want the scaffolding. So let me give you one other example. I can do something really basic like, let's go back here. Let's create one more new application. Turn off schema because I won't need this. And let's create a new component. We'll call this. I'm going to register it as an application. No database stuff is needed. I'm going to go to the source code. And then I'm going to go to rendering. Add a render content on. And this is going to be a very basic thing. I'm going to say HTML, all instances. And now the red is gone, so I know I've got the correct method. But I need to add my render process on method, so I'm going to come in here. You get to see firsthand my typing skills. So I'm just going to say HTML text process. I have to tell which process I'm rendering. That should work. So let's go ahead and try that. Browse process monitor. And there it's not very pretty, but that's all of the processes that are running in the system right now. If I wanted to make it look a little nicer, I can come in here and say HTML break. And there I have all the processes. Now, the reason I've got blanks in here is not all the processes that are running have names, because there are various ways of starting processes in Smalltalk, and not all of them involve naming them. But these are all the ones that have names, and then here there's some running. Now, I can give it other information, like, give it priority, print that out in a nice way, have a tabular layout, and I could walk you through that, but again, that would probably bore you to tears if I walked through each individual step. You've now got the idea of what I'm doing. Let me go back out to the top. I'm not going to take credit for this. One of our engineers, the lead engineer on this project, wrote this process monitor. And now if we go to the velocity, this guy here, let's go to browse, process monitor UI, gives me a link, and then it runs a little window up with all the processes running. And it actually is using JavaScript to update them. If you look at it, it'll periodically you'll see some of the hash numbers modify. So different processes are being swapped out there. So this is running every couple of seconds. It's updating this. And I have the ability to inspect these. So I can pick that and bring an inspector up on it. So if I click here, I should get an inspector. So it's going to bring me up a little inspector window, and I can look at it. So
there's multiple processes in the same image?
Smalltalk processes.
These days?
Smalltalk processes, they're green threads.
Oh, okay.
So, let me give you an idea of what's going on with this. Let's go back out here, and we'll go to the source code for this. So, let's go to classes, process monitor UI, source code. And you can see that I'm doing a bunch of things here. Render content on. And here, you can see how we're doing some JavaScript. And again, you don't necessarily have to write the JavaScript in the browser directly. It supports some basic stuff like onClick, put an HTML pop-up, and it's doing that. And then inside that, it has a little block that will execute periodically onClick, so it does self-render process monitor with that title. And that's how I'm getting the pop-up. It's including a JavaScript library, which is where that pop-up method is coming from. We've got a couple of different JavaScript libraries embedded in this that we've already got support for. So I've got that. Now, if I want to go in here, so render process monitor on, it's just a matter of putting out this kind of tabular view. And then each one of these is rendering the process. And if I want to look at how the process is rendered again, it's just putting this out. And again, I have this terminate and inspect is bringing up the individual inspectors for those and terminating them. So one of the things I can do is I can terminate processes and I can inspect them. And this is just a small little class that's not that hard to put together. And you get this kind of behavior. So that's really about all I had to present. I'm open to answer any questions you might have.
Do you recommend using Web Velocity if you're not using like a relational database, or just using like an image base?
This little application here doesn't use it's not using a relational database. You could put any kind of database behind it. Of course, you wouldn't get the advantage of the scaffolding because it's really relying on that active record pattern, but there's no requirement that you use that. You can take advantage of all the basic CSI functionality, the JavaScript libraries, and all the other stuff, and you can use all of that. You just lose the scaffolding. To be honest, the blog server I run on our site, I don't have a database behind that. Mm-hmm. I use serialized object files.
Do people on with WebVelocity, do they learn it in two stages? Like first learn about CSide and then learn about WebVelocity? I mean, do you have like waves of APIs to figure out?
I should have showed this. That's a good question. The best way to explain that, I suppose, is to go back here, go to this documentation tab, Smalltalk Basics. This is actually an interesting way for us to have laid out documentation. Classically, with VisionWorks and Object Studio, we've released a bunch of PDF files. PDF files are, these huge, massive documents that you have to wade through. Here, everything's been put on the web, so it's all running here in your server, so you can say, well, I want to know about Smalltalk syntax, I want to know about literals. There, I can learn about it right there, so it's all in the system. And this has mostly been scavenged from the system. It turns out there's a lot of latent documentation in the system already. It's just scattered around as class comments and package comments and other things, and it's never been really unified. One of the cool things about this product is that it kind of unifies that. So,
is there a CSide section there? Or is that just like merged with WebVelocity?
Well, it's Smalltalk Basic CSide Glorp, so you've got all this.
Oh, I see.
So you can go in here to the CSide piece.
What's Glorp is?
Glorp is our object relational mapper.
Okay.
Part of the reason we haven't included a ton of CSide documentation is that CSide is an open source project, while WebVelocity is a commercial product that Synchrom is selling. We haven't got it out yet, it's in beta right now, but CSide itself is open source. One of the things we're a little loath to do is go in and add documentation ourselves to a bunch of the core CSide stuff, because we're working right now in 2.8. 2.9 is under development. It's kind of an alpha stage, the way Julian Fitzell told me. We just interviewed him on the podcast. If you want to hear more about CSide, listen to last week's podcast because we interviewed Julian Fitzell about it. And they're adding a lot of that stuff to CSide already, so we didn't want to go in and add our own documentation into the system.
Sure. No, I'm kind of wondering on learning to build these tools, if you have to go through the stack of learning first, just figure out how to build with CSide, and then WebVelocity makes a whole lot of that easier.
WebVelocity is intended to make it easier.
So you still have to know what it is that you're making easier before you make it easier.
You can get a long ways with the scaffolding and just looking at the examples, and we're going to be shipping a lot of examples with the product, so you can kind of walk through the examples and see how stuff works. So you can get a long way with that. And then in addition to that, there is a CSide book that's out that you can buy. I can't remember what publisher it's from, but you can buy. There's a CSide book out now. There's one coming out next year. I can't
mention. I thought there was a self-published one up there. That's the only CSide book I've
That might be. I think it might be the Lula one. There is actually one from a major publisher coming out this year. I can't mention the publisher or the author because I've been told I'm not supposed to. But it is coming out this year.
You're coming to have beers with us later, right?
I don't drink beer.
Oh, okay.
If you're buying wine, I might say something.
Okay.
But I was asked not to say who it is, but it is a prominent author is writing a CSide book with a prominent publisher. So it's not it's not going to be from Joe's Bar and Grill publisher. It's going to be a real book.
Oh, that is a good book on Lulu. It's just they give it away for free and then ask you to pay for it too.
There's an actual book.
Or a sweet book.
CSide. It's only like 20 pages or something like that, but that's what I used. I gave a talk on one of the examples, one of the CSide examples, mm-hmm. and I used that.
Well, I've got a tutorial on our website also that goes over using basic CSide in our product. So if you wanted to learn CSide using the product I was demonstrating, actually this is also built on top of VisualWorks, what I'm showing you here, but if you wanted to learn base CSide, not so much WebVelocity, just base CSide, you can download the product. Suzanne has some CDs you can get from us if you're interested tonight. And CSide's on there. You can just load it straight off the CD. If you go to our website, syncomsmalltalk.com, and you go to Smalltalk Daily, you'll find there's a CSide section. and in Seaside there's a tutorial, and you can get it in two different kinds of formats. There's the read-along HTML with screenshots way of doing it, and then there's a bunch of screencasts, and they're all MP4s. So you can either watch a video, or you can watch or you can read the HTML, or obviously you can do both. And that's, I've got a tutorial that follows, roughly speaking, the tutorial that's been out there for a week for a long time, but I didn't use a to-do list, I used a walkthrough. But it's a fairly decently involved one. It walks through the major core functions of Seaside, gives you an idea of how it works.
What kind of issues do you see on deploying it? I mean, hooking up, how does that work with Apache?
You just proxy the path, basically. You just proxy the port. It's not terribly difficult. We're running, if I were online, I'd show you, but if you go to our website, if you go to simcomsmalltalk.com and you hit the support tag, right at the top there's a list of icons, and one of them is kind of a little light preserver. If you hit that one, it takes you to a support resolutions page, and that's a Seaside app.
Yeah. And so you run the server, you run the image
on the server
as a process.
Yeah. It runs on the server.
And then you need to run multiple processes ever to scale it up, or?
In that regard, it's just like any other site. It depends on how much traffic you get. I mean, if you're going to be the next dig, you're going to need to do that.
Well, but then you have questions about the state in each image is going to be different.
Right, but that's a problem you get into with any size of a web application. I mean, that answer is not different regardless of technology. You're going to need to figure out how to do that with almost anything. So you get into situations where you keep your state data, keep your application state back here, and you kind of cache it and move it back.
Because the state is encrypted in the URL.
That's session state for one individual user.
Right, so once you have affinity to a Smalltalk image running a process, you're there.
So you keep putting it back to the same process.
You can't load balance you off to another one.
Right, that's the way most of the load balancers work. And the thing is that from a scalability standpoint, the blog server I'm running, I've got one server image that's running the blog server and the main website for Simcom Smalltalk. My blog server alone gets about 20,000 page views a day. And the site takes whatever it takes, and then there's a bunch of other blogs that get less, but they get a fair number of page views. It's an image running on a relatively old Linux box. So, I mean, I had an interesting conversation with somebody a while ago where they were asking us how they could use Smalltalk and Seaside to write an application. And they were saying it had to be scalable, they had to be able to use multiple machines, they had to support a lot of users, and they had to have immediate back-end scaling, load balancing, and so on and so forth. And I finally asked him, how many users do you think will hit the system? He said, probably peaking up around 500. And his expectation was that if he was using Java, he'd need all that hardware. And the three of us small talkers in the room immediately, all we did was turn and look at each other, because we knew that 500 users is enough that you might conceivably need part of one image. If anybody wants a CD, we've got them, and thanks for coming out.
Oh, great. Thanks.
In this next segment, I have Dave Buck with this week's Cimbron Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. Recently, I needed to generate a file with a specific format based on information in the database. My first tendency was to implement a method like writeon for each of my domain objects and pass the file stream as a parameter. I quickly found that this technique was going to be difficult. Oftentimes, you don't know what information to write until you're past the point where you had the ability to write it. Sometimes the order that you traverse the domain objects isn't the best order to write them. What I find works best in these cases is to traverse the domain objects to create an intermediate form, then traverse the intermediate form to write the final file. This way, you have the option to augment, change, rearrange, or delete any information before you finally write it out. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more Smalltalkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the Industry Misinterpretations podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Smalltalkers group, or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with small talk.